It's a Saturday morning in the winter of 1980, and a team of IBM engineers from Boca Raton, Florida, is sitting in a conference room at a small software company in Bellevue, Washington. They've flown across the country because they're desperate. Their bosses in Armonk, IBM's headquarters in upstate New York, have given them 1 year to build a personal computer, and they've already burned 3 months. They need an operating system. They tried Digital Research first. That meeting went sideways. The stories vary, but the short version is that Gary Kildall, the creator of CPM, wasn't available to meet, and his wife signed a non-disclosure agreement, but not the deal IBM needed. So now the Boca Raton team is sitting across from a 24-year-old in oversized glasses who writes programming languages for a living.
His name is Bill Gates. And here's the thing that almost nobody outside the room understands at this moment. Gates does not own an operating system. Microsoft makes basic interpreters. They have nothing to license IBM. But Gates doesn't say that. He says yes. He tells the IBM team he can deliver what they need. Then he picks up the phone and calls a programmer across town.
Tim Patterson at Seattle Computer Products has built a quick clone of CPM for Intel's new 8086 chip. He calls it QDOS, Quick and Dirty Operating System. Gates licenses it, then buys it outright for $50,000. Patterson has no idea who the end customer is. He thinks it's for some generic project. Gates doesn't correct him.
And then Gates does something that the 12 lawyers on IBM's side of the table should have caught and didn't. He structures the license as non-exclusive. IBM gets the right to use the operating system. Microsoft retains the right to license it to anyone else who builds an IBM-compatible machine. IBM's legal team approves this because they think they're buying a commodity, a minor component for a side project. They believe the value is in the hardware. They believe the IBM brand, the IBM sales force, and the IBM service network are the moat. The operating system is just plumbing.
They're signing away the monopoly for the next 30 years. And they don't know it because they think they're in the hardware business.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is episode 4. So that scene, Gates promising an operating system he doesn't own to the most powerful technology company on Earth, then buying it from a guy who doesn't know who the real buyer is, then structuring the license so that Microsoft keeps the keys to the kingdom. That's the founding move. And the thing I keep coming back to is that every single person in that room made a rational decision based on the information they had. Patterson rationally sold something he thought was a small deal. IBM rationally signed terms they thought were irrelevant. And Gates, who was the only person who understood the full picture, rationally captured the entire surplus. Information asymmetry is the most powerful force in business.
Today we're doing Microsoft, and I want to frame this carefully because I think Microsoft is the most strategically important company in the history of the technology industry. Not the most innovative, that's probably Apple or Bell Labs. Not the most beloved. Nobody has a Microsoft tattoo. But in terms of understanding how power actually works in technology markets, how you build a standard, how you defend it, how you weaponize it, and how you survive losing it, Microsoft is the essential case study, full stop.
And the emotional register of this story is different from the others we've done. Fairchild is romantic, dollar bills and defection. Intel is dramatic, the memory crisis, Grove's reinvention. Apple is operatic, exile, return, redemption. Microsoft is, I think the right word is clinical. Gates isn't a showman. He doesn't give speeches that make you cry. He sees the board, he sees the moves, and he executes with a precision that is genuinely unsettling sometimes.
I wouldn't say unsettling. I'd say clear. Gates had a clarity about where value would accumulate in the PC ecosystem that nobody else possessed. Not IBM, not Apple, not any of the dozens of hardware manufacturers who thought they were in the computer business. Gates understood, before anyone, that the operating system was the choke point. Everything else was a commodity. and he spent 30 years defending that choke point with every tool available to him, including some that landed him in federal court.
All right, trivia. Here's the question. When Bill Gates licensed MS-DOS to IBM in 1981, he didn't actually own the operating system. He bought it from a programmer in Seattle after the IBM meeting. What was the original name of the OS, and what did its creator think he was selling?
This one is genuinely painful.
If you're playing along, pause now. The answer? The operating system was called QDOS, Quick and Dirty Operating System. Tim Patterson built it at Seattle Computer Products as a quick and dirty clone of CPM for the Intel 8086 processor. Gates paid $50,000 initially, later $75,000 for full rights. And Patterson had absolutely no idea that the application was IBM. He thought he was selling to Microsoft for some generic client project.
And the stakes of that information gap are staggering. If Patterson had known the buyer was IBM, that this operating system was about to ship on the most important personal computer in history, he would have demanded equity or royalties or a price that reflected what the thing was actually worth. The $50,000 purchase, made possible entirely by one party knowing something the other party didn't, became the legal foundation of everything Microsoft is today.
It's the most consequential $50,000 in the history of commerce.
Remember last episode when we talked about Bizicom selling Intel the rights to the microprocessor for $60,000? This might be worse.
It's worse. Bizicom didn't understand what a microprocessor could become. That's forgivable. Nobody did. Patterson understood perfectly well what an operating system was. He just didn't know who was buying his.
That's a devastating distinction. And the ethical dimension, let's just name it. Gates didn't lie to Patterson. He simply withheld the identity of the client. That's technically legal. Whether it's right is a conversation that has no clean ending, and it hangs over the early Microsoft story like weather.
The early Microsoft story has a lot of those moments. Brilliant strategy, complicated ethics, world-reshaping outcomes. They're braided together. You can't pull them apart.
Let's set the stage. Microsoft is founded in 1975, but the deal that defines the company happens in 1980. So let me bridge those two moments, because the bridge matters.
In January 1975, Paul Allen sees the Altair 8800 on the cover of Popular Electronics. He shows it to Bill Gates at Harvard. They realize immediately that this hobbyist computer is going to need software, specifically a version of BASIC that can run on the Altair's Intel 8080 processor. They call MITs, the company that makes the Altair, and they claim to have a working version of BASIC. They don't. They don't have a single line of code.
Not one line.
They write it in about 8 weeks on a PDP-10 mainframe at Harvard, using Harvard's computer, on Harvard's electricity, on Harvard's time. Allen flies to MIT's headquarters in Albuquerque, New Mexico, loads the program from a paper tape, and it works. First try. On hardware they've never physically touched. That is genuinely remarkable engineering, and it's the proof of concept for the entire Gates thesis.
And that thesis is simple, and it never changes. Software is where the value is. Not hardware. Not manufacturing. Software. Because software has near zero marginal cost. You write it once, and you can sell it infinite times. The economics of software are fundamentally different from the economics of hardware. A chip fab costs billions. A copy of DOS costs nothing to produce. Gates grasps this before almost anyone else in the industry, and he builds his entire career around it.
Now fast forward 5 years to 1980. The PC market is materializing. Apple is selling Apple IIs. The Altair has spawned dozens of hobbyist machines. And IBM, the colossus, the 800-pound gorilla of American technology, the company whose name is literally synonymous with the word computer, decides it needs a personal computer.
And the context for IBM's decision matters enormously. IBM in 1980 is the most powerful technology company on Earth. Their mainframe business generates billions in annual revenue. Their brand is unassailable. When IBM decides to build a PC, it's like General Motors deciding to build a bicycle. They're doing it because the market exists and they don't want to cede it to Apple, not because they think the PC is strategically important. The PC is a side project, a defensive hedge, something to keep the hobbyists and the small businesses from drifting toward Cupertino.
And because it's a side project, the Boca Raton team gets permission to do things that IBM would never normally do. Use outside suppliers, publish the architecture, ship on a commercial timeline instead of an IBM timeline. Every one of these decisions, made for speed and convenience, made because nobody in Armonk is paying close attention to the side project, will destroy IBM's dominance in computing.
Oh, that last point is so important. Nobody in Armonk is paying attention. The executives who run IBM's mainframe business, which is where the real money is, view the PC project the way a five-star restaurant views the vending machine in its lobby. It's there. It serves a purpose. Nobody's worried about it. And that inattention is exactly the opening that Gates walks through.
The IBM team comes to Microsoft in the fall of 1980. They've already been to Digital Research. That visit is one of the great what-if moments in tech history. Gary Kildall, the creator of CPM, which is the dominant operating system for microcomputers, either went flying or was at a meeting or simply didn't make himself available. The stories conflict. What's clear is that Digital Research didn't close the deal, and IBM's team left frustrated and went to Gates.
And Gates doesn't have an operating system. Microsoft makes programming languages, BASIC, Fortran, COBOL, languages, not operating systems. But Gates sees the opportunity with a clarity that is almost eerie in retrospect. He tells IBM he can deliver an OS, then he goes across town and buys one.
Here's the insider detail that makes this story incredible. Gates didn't own DOS when he promised it to IBM. He bought QDOS from Tim Patterson after the IBM meeting for $50,000. He committed to delivering a product he didn't possess to the most powerful technology company on earth, and then went out and acquired it. That's not entrepreneurship. That's arbitrage on a civilizational scale.
And it only works because Gates understands the full topology of the deal, and nobody else does. Patterson doesn't know IBM is the buyer. IBM doesn't know Gates doesn't own the product yet. Gates is the only person in the triangle who sees all three sides. And he uses that information advantage to structure terms that favor Microsoft at every turn.
The critical term, the one that changes everything, is non-exclusivity. IBM gets the right to use MS-DOS on the IBM PC. Microsoft retains the right to license it to anyone else who builds an IBM-compatible machine. And IBM's lawyers approve this. Let me say that again. IBM's lawyers, the legal department of the most powerful technology company on earth, a company that had been doing technology licensing deals for decades, approved the non-exclusive term.
And the reason they approve it is the second insider detail. IBM's lawyers didn't understand they'd given away the franchise because they believed hardware was the business. In their mental model, the IBM PC was an IBM product. The brand was the moat. The service network was the moat. The sales relationships with Fortune 500 CIOs were the moat. The operating system was a purchased component, like a power supply or a floppy drive. You don't demand exclusivity on a power supply. IBM's lawyers treated the OS license the way they'd treat any commodity input. Get it cheap, get it fast, move on to the real work.
They were making the same category error we discussed in the Intel episode. IBM believed hardware was the strategic asset and software was a commodity. They were exactly, perfectly, 100% wrong. The hardware became a commodity. Anyone with a screwdriver and a cleanroom BIOS could build a clone. The software, the operating system, became the choke point that every clone manufacturer had to pay for.
And then the compounding starts. Compaq ships the first IBM-compatible clone in 1982. Then dozens more. Then hundreds. Every single clone runs MS-DOS because every clone needs to be IBM-compatible. And IBM-compatible means MS-DOS-compatible. Microsoft collects a royalty on every unit shipped, and because every clone runs MS-DOS, every software developer writes for MS-DOS because that's where the users are. The installed base grows, the software library grows. The installed base grows faster because the software library is growing. The software library grows faster because the installed base is growing.
It's the most perfect flywheel in business history. Each turn of the wheel makes the next turn faster. Users attract developers, developers attract users, and Microsoft sits in the middle, collecting a toll on every rotation.
Within 5 years, the IBM-compatible PC market is generating tens of billions of dollars in annual hardware revenue, and Gates is getting a cut of every machine. He didn't build a product. he built a toll booth, and the highway just keeps getting wider.
And every lane pays the same toll. That's the beauty of it from Microsoft's perspective. Whether the clone is made by Compaq or Dell or some no-name manufacturer in Shenzhen, they all need DOS. The toll is the same.
So the DOS monopoly is the foundation. But Microsoft's next move is where the strategic playbook gets really sophisticated, and it starts with a graphical user interface.
Apple popularizes the GUI with the Macintosh in 1984. Windows, icons, a mouse, the whole visual paradigm. Both Apple and Microsoft borrowed the core concepts from Xerox PARC, as we discussed in the Apple episode. Microsoft ships Windows 1.0 in 1985, and it's not good. Windows 2.0 in 1987 is marginally better. Windows 3.0 in 1990 is the breakthrough, the first version that's genuinely usable, that ordinary people can navigate, that ships in serious volume.
And Apple sues. In 1988, Apple alleges that Windows copies the look and feel of the Macintosh. Apple loses. The court rules that the visual elements of a graphical interface aren't copyrightable. This decision, which Apple considers an absolute travesty, removes the last legal barrier to Microsoft competing directly with the Mac's interface paradigm. Windows is free to look and feel like the Mac, and it's running on hardware that costs half as much.
But Windows alone doesn't explain the dominance of the 90s. The second weapon is Office, and this is where the bundling playbook becomes a case study that business schools will teach forever.
Let me set up the economics, because this is where it gets wild. In 1989, the productivity software market has three champions. WordPerfect dominates word processing, about $495. Lotus 1-2-3 dominates spreadsheets, about $500. Harvard Graphics dominates presentations, about $495. If you're a business buyer and you want best-in-class tools, you're spending roughly $1,500 and managing three separate vendor relationships.
In 1990, Microsoft bundles Word, Excel, and PowerPoint into a single product called Microsoft Office. Price, about $750. Half the cost, one vendor, one installation, shared clipboard, consistent interface. It's a genuinely better deal for the customer, and it's an extinction-level event for WordPerfect, Lotus, and Harvard Graphics.
Because here's the structural trap. Microsoft can afford to price Word below WordPerfect because Microsoft makes money on Windows, on Excel, on server tools, on a dozen other product lines. If Word loses money at $750 bundled, Microsoft absorbs it. WordPerfect can't match the bundle price because WordPerfect is a single product company. Their entire revenue comes from word processing. If they cut their price to match Office, they go bankrupt. The bundle exploits the fact that a diversified company can sustain losses on individual products that a specialist company structurally cannot.
And it's not predatory pricing in the legal sense. The bundle genuinely creates value for the customer. Better integration, lower total cost, simpler vendor management. It's a legitimately superior offering that also happens to be an economic death sentence for anyone competing with only one piece of the bundle.
Within 5 years, WordPerfect, Lotus, and Harvard Graphics are effectively dead. Microsoft Office becomes the global default for productivity software. Every business document, every spreadsheet, every presentation is in a Microsoft format. The cost of switching away means reformatting everything, retraining every employee, and explaining to your CEO why the quarterly report looks different. Nobody switches.
And right as this consolidation is finishing, the internet arrives, and Microsoft nearly misses it entirely.
In 1994, a company called Netscape releases Navigator, a web browser that makes the internet usable for ordinary people. And Netscape's strategy, articulated explicitly by co-founder Marc Andreessen, who is 23 years old at the time, is to turn the browser into a platform. If applications run in the browser instead of on the operating system, then it doesn't matter what OS you're running. Windows becomes irrelevant. The browser becomes the new operating system.
Gates recognizes this immediately. In May 1995, he writes the Internet Tidal Wave Memo, one of the most famous internal documents in corporate history. He tells every executive at Microsoft that the internet is the most important development since the IBM PC and that the entire company needs to redirect to respond. And give Gates credit. The man is 50 moves deep in a chess game that most people haven't started playing. And when he sees a piece he missed, he recalibrates in weeks, not years.
Microsoft's response is Internet Explorer, a web browser that they bundle free with Windows 95 and then more aggressively with Windows 98. Free. Built into the operating system. No separate purchase, no separate download. You buy Windows, you get Explorer. You can't not get Explorer.
And the strategic logic is the same as the Office bundle, just more brutal. Netscape charges for Navigator. Their revenue depends on selling the browser. Microsoft gives Explorer away, subsidized entirely by Windows revenue. Netscape is trying to sell water next to a company that's giving it away for free and can afford to do so indefinitely. There is no competitive response to free when your opponent has a different profit center funding the giveaway.
And the internal language at Microsoft, which came out during the antitrust discovery process, was embrace, extend, extinguish. Embrace the open standard. Extend it with proprietary features that only work in Internet Explorer. Extinguish the competition once developers are dependent on the proprietary extensions.
That phrase, embrace, extend, extinguish. It sounds like it was written by the villain in a movie, except it was an actual internal email at an actual company describing their actual competitive strategy. And the thing is, it worked. Internet Explorer went from 0 to 95% market share in about 4 years.
And it got them sued. The Department of Justice files an antitrust case against Microsoft in 1998. The trial is a spectacle. Gates's videotaped deposition becomes a PR catastrophe. He's evasive, combative, at one point quibbling about the definition of the word concern, while the courtroom audibly laughs. Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson rules in 2000 that Microsoft violated the Sherman Antitrust Act, the foundational 1890 law prohibiting monopolistic business practices, and orders the company broken in two, an operating system company and an applications company.
Microsoft appeals. The breakup order is reversed. The case settles in 2001 under terms widely regarded as a slap on the wrist. Microsoft pays no structural penalty. The monopoly survives legally intact.
But here's the hidden cost, and this is the third insider detail. The antitrust trial distracted Microsoft for 3 years during the most critical period of internet history. From 1998 to 2001, while Gates and Ballmer and Microsoft's senior leadership are sitting in depositions and courtrooms and strategy meetings about the trial, the rest of the technology industry is inventing the future. The iPod ships in 2001. Google is scaling to dominance. The mobile internet is beginning to take shape, and Microsoft, the most strategically capable company in the industry, has its best minds focused on lawyers instead of products.
So, the weapon worked. Internet Explorer won the browser war. But the side effects of winning, the antitrust scrutiny, the 3 years of management distraction, the cultural shift from aggression to legal caution, those side effects cost Microsoft the mobile era. The browser war was a tactical victory and a strategic catastrophe.
And the deeper irony is almost too perfect. Microsoft's entire existence was built on IBM's failure to understand that the operating system mattered more than the hardware. IBM thought hardware was the game and the OS was a commodity. 30 years later, Microsoft makes the identical error in reverse. They assume the desktop OS is the permanent center of gravity and miss the mobile OS, which is where the next 2 decades of value creation will happen.
So IBM misses the OS, Microsoft misses mobile. Every generation's dominant company makes the same mistake in a different direction. They always believe the layer they control is the layer that matters forever. For 14 years under Steve Ballmer, from 2000 to 2014, Microsoft is the case study in wasted dominance. Windows Mobile fails. The Zune music player fails. The Surface tablet arrives late. Bing is a distant second to Google. Microsoft's stock price flatlines for over a decade while Apple, Google, and Amazon go parabolic.
I mean, the Ballmer era is almost physically painful to watch in retrospect. The company has every advantage. Cash, talent, distribution, brand, enterprise relationships, and it squanders all of them because every product decision is filtered through one question. Does this strengthen Windows? If the answer is no, the project gets starved. If the answer is yes, but the project might cannibalize Windows, it gets killed. The monopoly becomes a gravitational field that bends every decision toward protecting a desktop operating system while the world migrates to phones.
And then Satya Nadella becomes CEO in February 2014 and executes what I believe is the most impressive corporate transformation of the 21st century.
Nadella does three things, and all three would have been heresy under Ballmer. First, he shifts Microsoft's center of gravity from Windows to cloud computing. Azure becomes the growth engine. Second, he transforms Office from a one-time boxed purchase into a subscription, Office 365, creating recurring revenue that Wall Street loves. Third, and this is the one that signals the cultural break, he makes Microsoft a partner instead of a predator. He ships Office for iPhone, he embraces Linux. Linux, the thing Ballmer once called a cancer. He buys GitHub, the open source platform. He invests $10 billion in OpenAI.
The Ballmer to Nadella transition is the single strongest argument I know for the importance of CEO selection. It's the same company, same assets, same employees, same market position, different leader, completely different outcome.
Microsoft's market capitalization when Nadella took over was roughly $300 billion. Today, it exceeds $3 trillion. That's a 10x increase. The man who had the courage to say Windows is not the future created more value than the man who built the Windows monopoly in the first place.
Let me just say that back because I want listeners to sit with it. Deprioritizing the monopoly created more value than building the monopoly.
And that's why the person sitting in the CEO chair matters more than any other variable in a company's trajectory.
Let's run the analytical framework on Microsoft. And I want to argue that Microsoft is the single best case study for understanding how multiple sources of durable advantage reinforce each other. Most companies have one moat, maybe two. Microsoft at its peak had five operating simultaneously.
Go.
Start with the switching costs, because that's the foundation. Every application written for Windows creates a reason not to leave. Every document saved in a Microsoft format creates a reason not to leave. Every IT department that's trained its staff on Windows, every enterprise that's built its infrastructure on Windows Server and Active Directory, every custom application that only runs on Internet Explorer, all of it is accumulated switching cost. And the critical thing is these costs aren't individual, they're systemic. The cost of switching away from Windows isn't buying a different OS. It's retraining every employee, reformatting every document, rewriting every internal application, and replacing every server. For a Fortune 500 company, that cost is measured in hundreds of millions of dollars.
And the switching costs compound. Every year you stay on Windows, you create more documents, install more applications, train more employees. The cost of leaving grows every year you don't leave. It's a trap that gets tighter the longer you're in it.
Second, and this is the one that built the flywheel, the network effects. The Windows developer ecosystem is the textbook example. More users attract more developers because that's where the customers are. More developers create more applications because they want to reach those customers. More applications attract more users because the platform with the most software is the most useful platform. This two-sided flywheel made Windows effectively unassailable for 20 years, not just for consumer applications, for enterprise tools, development environments, hardware drivers, middleware, the entire ecosystem.
And then scale economics. Software has near zero marginal cost. Every copy of Windows costs Microsoft essentially nothing to produce after the R&D is done. So the fixed costs, the billions spent on development, marketing, sales, get spread across hundreds of millions of units. No competitor can match Microsoft's per unit economics because no competitor has Microsoft's volume. This is why Linux, despite being literally free, couldn't displace Windows on the desktop. Free wasn't cheap enough. The switching costs of leaving Windows exceeded the price difference, which means the incumbent was more expensive and still won. That tells you how powerful the switching costs were.
And here's the one I find most analytically interesting, the counterpositioning against Netscape. By giving Internet Explorer away for free, Microsoft adopted a business model that Netscape structurally could not copy. Netscape's revenue came from selling the browser. If Netscape gives the browser away, Netscape has no revenue. Microsoft can give the browser away because Microsoft's revenue comes from Windows. Netscape is trapped. They can't match free without destroying their own business. And that's the purest form of competitive asymmetry. When your opponent's survival depends on charging for the exact thing you're giving away.
Well, I want to add the cornered resource dimension because I think the IBM deal deserves its own category. The relationship with IBM, the fact that IBM chose Microsoft, that the license was non-exclusive, that Gates happened to know about QDOS when nobody at IBM did, that was a cornered resource in time. It wasn't permanent. Once the deal was signed and the clones appeared, the cornered resource shifted from the IBM relationship to the installed base itself. The spark became the fire. The resource became the network. But without that initial cornered resource, being the right person in the right room at the right moment with the right information, none of the rest of it happens.
That's a good distinction. The IBM deal was the spark. The network effects were the fire. And Gates was the person who understood that the spark could start a fire, while everyone else in the room thought they were just lighting a candle.
And he was the arsonist. I mean, that is a structural compliment.
Noted.
You know, if this kind of breakdown is useful to you, mapping out how multiple competitive advantages stack on top of each other, the online course at svstrategy.xyz goes way deeper. It has a technology waves timeline that maps every platform shift from transistors to AI, plus mystery company simulations where you make the strategic calls yourself in real time. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz, really good stuff. Three frameworks from the Microsoft story.
Go.
Framework one, own the standard, not the product. This is the deepest lesson here. MS-DOS was, by essentially every technical assessment, an inferior operating system. It was worse than CPM. It was laughably worse than the Mac OS. Gates didn't win by building a better product. He won by making his product the default, the thing every application was written for, the thing every hardware manufacturer shipped with, the thing every IT department standardized on. The difference between owning a product and owning a standard is the difference between selling a car and owning the road. Every car has to use the road. Every application has to run on the OS. If you own the road, you collect a toll on every car, regardless of who made it.
And the mechanism for owning the standard, the actual practical mechanism, was the non-exclusive license. If Gates had given IBM an exclusive license, MS-DOS would have been IBM's OS. It would have lived and died with IBM's hardware. The non-exclusive term meant that when the clone market emerged, every clone needed DOS too. The standard propagated automatically with the hardware ecosystem. Gates didn't have to sell to each clone manufacturer individually. They came to him because IBM compatible meant MS-DOS compatible, and they had no alternative.
Framework 2, bundling as competitive weapon. Microsoft used bundling twice to devastating effect. Once against the standalone productivity apps, WordPerfect, Lotus, Harvard Graphics, once against Netscape. The underlying structure is identical both times. A diversified company can afford to sell any individual product at or below cost because losses on that product are subsidized by other product lines. A specialist competitor, a company that makes one thing, cannot match the bundle price without destroying its own economics. Bundling isn't charity for the customer, although customers often benefit. It's a structural exploit. You're using your breadth to attack their depth.
And I want to push back on framing it purely as a weapon, because I think that's incomplete. Office genuinely was worth more as a bundle than the individual products were worth separately. The integration, pasting an Excel chart into a Word document, building a PowerPoint deck from Word outlines, created real functionality that standalone products couldn't replicate. Bundling created value and destroyed competitors simultaneously. Those aren't contradictory. That's what makes it so strategically elegant and so ethically complicated.
Fair. The antitrust case was ultimately about that exact tension. When does value creation become market abuse? And the courts never fully resolved it.
Framework 3.
Platform revival. Nadella's transformation is the best modern example of how a company that has decisively lost a platform shift can survive and even thrive by finding the next one. Microsoft lost mobile, completely, irretrievably lost it. they had no meaningful presence in the smartphone era. But instead of continuing to throw money at the lost war, which is what Ballmer did for years with Windows Phone and the Nokia acquisition, Nadella recognized that mobile wasn't the last transition. Cloud was next. And in the cloud, Microsoft had enormous structural advantages that the mobile winners didn't. Enterprise relationships built over decades, developer tools, data center infrastructure, the Azure platform. The framework is simple, but emotionally brutal. If you've lost a paradigm shift, stop trying to win the paradigm you lost. Accept the loss, grieve it, and then find the next paradigm and position for it before the current winners do.
The emotional discipline that requires is extraordinary. Ballmer spent billions trying to win mobile, Windows Phone, Nokia, years of effort. Nadella said, stop, we lost, it's over. What's next? That willingness to accept defeat on the biggest battlefield in technology, to actually internalize that Windows was not going to be the center of the next era, that's the hardest leadership decision in this entire course. It's the same courage Andy Grove showed when he exited memory chips, except Grove was under existential pressure. Nadella pivoted from strength. Windows was still printing money. He walked away from a winning hand because he could see the game was changing. What does a founder take from the Microsoft story?
I want to start with the non-exclusive license because I think it contains the most important strategic insight in this entire course. When Gates structured the IBM deal as non-exclusive, he was making a bet about where value would concentrate in the PC ecosystem. IBM bet on hardware, on the brand, the distribution, the service relationships. Gates bet on the standard, on being the thing that every machine in the ecosystem required. The non-exclusive term meant that when the clone market exploded, Microsoft's operating system rode the growth of the entire hardware ecosystem, not just IBM's. This is the difference between building a product company and building a platform company. A product company sells units. A platform company creates a standard and collects a toll on every unit that runs on the standard. The toll is smaller per unit, but the volume is incomparably larger.
And the lesson for founders today, before you build, ask yourself, is there a choke point in this value chain, and can I own it? The choke point isn't always the product. It might be the API, the data format, the developer tools, the authentication layer, the model weights, whatever it is, the choke point is the position that everything else must flow through. Gates didn't set out to build the best operating system. He set out to own the layer that every application needed.
The second lesson is about the danger of your greatest strength becoming your greatest liability. Microsoft's Windows monopoly was the most powerful competitive position in the history of technology, and it nearly destroyed the company. Because when you have a monopoly, every decision gets filtered through the lens of protecting it. Should we build for mobile? Only if it strengthens Windows. Should we support Linux? Not if it threatens Windows. Should we invest in cloud? Only if the cloud runs Windows. This defensive crouch, this gravitational pull of the existing monopoly, blinded Microsoft to every platform shift for 15 years. The thing that made them dominant was the thing that made them slow.
And Nadella's genius was escaping that gravity. Mobile first, cloud first, not Windows first. The willingness to deprioritize the thing that built the company is the same strategic pattern we saw with Grove exiting DRAM. The difference is timing. Grove pivoted under existential threat. Nadella pivoted while the legacy business was still enormously profitable. Pivoting from strength is rarer and arguably harder, because nobody inside the company is screaming that the building is on fire. You have to light the fire yourself. Takeaways, you first.
My first takeaway is about the IBM deal, and it's about information asymmetry as a strategic weapon. The $50,000 purchase of QDOS and the non-exclusive license to IBM is, dollar for dollar, the most consequential business transaction in history. And the reason it happened is that Gates understood the system while his counterparties understood only their positions within it. Patterson knew what an operating system was, but not who was buying his. IBM knew what a personal computer was, but not that the OS would matter more than the hardware. Gates saw the full topology, the clone market that would emerge, the network effects that would compound, the toll booth economics of owning the standard. In moments of deep uncertainty, the person who understands the system-level dynamics better than the counterparty will capture a disproportionate share of the value. That's not luck. It's the highest form of strategic thinking. The framework here is platform lock-in through standard ownership. Once the ecosystem adopts your layer, every participant's investment reinforces your position and raises the cost of any alternative.
My first takeaway is Nadella. Microsoft under Ballmer was worth $300 billion and was considered a declining legacy company. A punchline, almost. Microsoft under Nadella is worth $3 trillion and is considered one of the most innovative companies in the world. The product line didn't change that dramatically. The strategy changed. And the strategy changed because the leader changed. This is the most powerful argument in the entire course for the importance of CEO selection. The board that hired Nadella made a $3 trillion decision. Most boards think about CEO searches as HR processes. They should think about them as the single highest leverage capital allocation decision they'll ever make.
Well, my second takeaway is a warning about bundling, and the framework is that competitive weapons have recoil. Microsoft used bundling to destroy WordPerfect, Lotus, Netscape, and a dozen other competitors. Bundling works. It's one of the most devastating competitive weapons available to a diversified platform company. You use your breadth to subsidize individual products below the price any specialist can match. But the bundling playbook against Netscape triggered the antitrust case, and the antitrust case consumed Microsoft's senior leadership for 3 critical years. During those 3 years, the mobile revolution began, Google scaled to dominance, and the entire technology landscape reorganized around platforms Microsoft wasn't building. Network effects were compounding in ecosystems that Microsoft wasn't part of, and every quarter of distraction widened the gap irreversibly. The weapon worked. The side effects cost Microsoft the next era.
My second takeaway is personal. I keep thinking about the moment in 1980 when IBM's lawyers signed the non-exclusive license. These were the best corporate lawyers in America, working for the most powerful technology company on earth, negotiating a deal they'd done hundreds of times before. And they signed a clause that gave away the operating system monopoly for the next 30 years because they didn't understand what they were signing. They thought they were licensing a commodity component for a side project in a product line that nobody in Armonk took seriously. The non-exclusive term was, in their eyes, a minor detail, a concession to a small vendor who wanted to keep reselling his little program to other little companies, and it became the most valuable clause in the history of corporate law. The lesson I carry from that, the most important terms in any deal are the ones that seem unimportant at the time. Pay ferocious attention to the details you think don't matter. Those are the ones that change everything. Before we go, the online course at svstrategy.exyz has a whole section on platform economics and bundling strategy that goes way deeper than we can in the show. Plus full podcast transcripts with section navigation so you can jump to any framework. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz. All right, next time on the show, the PC wars, Dell, Compaq, and the question of what happens when the product becomes a commodity and the only differentiator left is the business model, Michael Dell's dorm room, negative working capital, and why the company that never invented a single technology might have been the most innovative of them all.
Business model innovation, my favorite kind of innovation.
You would say that. The analyst loves the company that wins on spreadsheets instead of products.
Guilty. We'll see you then.